all of the support that this council gets from the First District staff, and also the all of the support that the industry gets from the First District as well. But thank you, and welcome to the council process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, congratulations on your re-election, your unanimous re-election, and welcome to all the new council members. There's a number of COSIs in the audience, so in the interest of time, I'm going to forgo personal introductions, but as you've noted, Admiral Abel sits to my right, and he'll present some brief remarks following my my report. For the period of 1 June and 19 September, the Coast Guard boarded 462 fishing vessels and issued three significant violations, resulting in an at-sea observed compliance rate of 99.4%, which is slightly above the last reporting period. There was one violation of note was the detected use of a net liner during a northeast multi-species trip. In this case, the vessel operator had two 6.5-inch caught ends, one installed, one inside the other, to effectively reduce the net mesh size. On the safety side, during those same 462 boardings, 73 vessels were issued safety violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 84.2%, slightly below the last reporting period and well within our standard for this reporting metric. And also, during the reporting period, we responded to 57 fishing vessel casualties, 13 medevacs, 11 medevacs, and assisted 138 fishermen in two commercial fishing vessel voyages were terminated for safety reasons. One final note with respect to safety is mandated by the Coast Guard Authorization Act of 2010. Beginning on October 16th, all commercial fishing vessels that operate beyond 3 nautical miles, the baseline for which the territorial sea is measured, will have to demonstrate compliance with existing safety standards. The most straightforward way to demonstrate compliance with this requirement is by having a commercial fishing vessel safety decal. Two additional methods include having a form CG-5587, which is the fishing vessel safety exam form, signed by a Coast Guard examiner, or having a signed letter of compliance from an accepted third-party organization such as a marine surveyor as proof that your vessel is compliant with current regulations. Eventually, a certificate of compliance will be issued by safety examiners, but the regulations for that program are in the early stages of the rulemaking process. We'll keep you informed throughout the rulemaking process, and when the interim rule is published for those for that program and available for public comment, we'll let you know. Oops. To implement this program, our fishing vessel safety staff has engaged in an extensive outreach program over the past several months to notify state and federal permit holders to promote awareness of this new requirement. And given the significant workload that this mandate represents over the current voluntary program, the Coast Guard has hired additional fishing vessel safety examiners. But even with this extra help in working full-time conducting inspections, we fully expect that there'll be more inspections that need to be done than people able to do them by the October 16th deadline. Recognizing this, there will be a phase-in period designed to keep people fishing, where if you can't get an exam scheduled, the examiner can issue a letter to be kept on board your boat that when you have an exam acknowledging when you have an exam scheduled. This phase-in period is designed to give the Coast Guard and industry as much flexibility as possible while remaining responsive to the congressional intent. As always, early and open communication between vessel owners and operators and the examiners is strongly encouraged. There's a handout available on the table with the phone numbers of all the fishing vessel examiners from Maine to New Jersey on the table, and for more information, you can look at you can find it on fishsafe.info. We fully understand the challenges that the expansion of the safety program brings and hope to work with industry to successfully implement it as painlessly as possible. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions that the council members might have.
David Pierce.
Yes, thank you for that report. You showed a slide of a violation with a liner and a caught in. Was that the only violation for that particular trip? I assume it was on a trip at sea, and he was found with a liner. Any other violation of minimum fish sizes, for example?
No, No, there was no violation for minimum fish size. It was simply the net.
Okay, so that, but that was done at sea, obviously.
Yes,
okay.
That was at sea.
All right, I should know this, but I can't recall. When that sort of a violation occurs, how is that particular information transmitted to NOAA Fisheries? For example, the reason why I ask, sector management involves sectors having a stewardship responsibility. Their members towing the line, so to speak. Everyone's held accountable for the violations of individual fishermen, depending upon the nature of the violation. So how is that information provided to, for example, the sector group at NOAA Fisheries, so they can act on it and inform perhaps sectors that there's a problem with one of the members?
The information goes from us straight to NOAA. We put together a case package, review the case package, and then submit it to NOAA. We don't submit it to the sector at all at that point. What NOAA does with it and how they share it with the sector commander, I couldn't speak to. It's a case. We're certainly not going to reveal the information of that case before its appropriate time.
I'll pursue this with NOAA Fisheries afterwards, Mr. Chairman, since this is a very important thing. When you get a violation like that, it needs to be tended to.
I agree, and your point is well taken, Dr. Pierce. Certainly something for us to consider as we continue down the road with enforcement of the sectors.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, following up on what Dr. Pierce said, two things. One is we have to find out if it's a sector or it could have been a common pool vessel. But I have to say that picture is probably the most discouraging thing I've seen since I've been on this council. I mean, we've worked very hard to raise the minimum mesh size to get to a point where the minimum fish size and the minimum mesh size match up. Now, clearly somebody thought there was an advantage now to doing something to circumvent that situation, and this calls into question probably one of the central items we're working on in Framework 48 for groundfish, which is reducing the minimum fish sizes. And this is what I've been afraid of right along. And so I really think we need a lot more information on this particular case. We need to know if it's a common pool or sector vessel. We need to know how the sector is going to have to deal with this if it is a sector vessel. The joint and several liability issue. This calls into question pretty much everything we're doing in groundfish at the moment. And that picture is, I just can't tell you. I don't even want to eat lunch now.
Back to you, Pete. Admiral.
Okay. That concludes my report. It's my pleasure to introduce Rear Admiral Abel. Rear Admiral Abel assumed command of the 1st Coast Guard District in May of 2012. Prior to reporting to the 1st District, his first flag assignment was for 2 years at the Department of Defense's United States Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, as the Deputy Director of Operations. A naval aviator, Admiral Abel has served at air stations Houston, Miami, and at Aviation Training Center Mobile, Alabama, and commanding officer of Air Station San Francisco. Prior to his promotion to Admiral, he served as commanding officer of Air Station Cape Cod from 2007 to 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, Admiral Abel.
Well, good afternoon. Despite Pete's attempt to turn you off from lunch, I am between you and lunch, and I'm sensitive to that, so I'm going to keep my comments very, very short. Pete mentioned that I just came from Colorado. Obviously, the Coast Guard presence in Colorado is fairly small, and I would be confronted in public with what's the Coast Guard doing in Colorado. My usual retort was, global warming is for real, the water's coming, and we're scouting where Coast Guard Station Pikes Peak will be and what type pier facilities are required, and usually got an interesting response from the public. But anyway, glad to be back close to the water. When I first showed up here, I made it clear to the folks, the 11,000 folks that work in the Coast Guard 1st District, that we have three priorities. Number one is we're going to be a crew of professionals. When people call someone in this uniform, they expect a master mariner, a master marine inspector, or they expect a master aviator, and we're going to deliver on that. There's no question about that. Second of all, we're going to be a creative and supportive team. We're going to look out for each other. And the third part is we're going to build our trusted partnerships, and that is the key of what this body seeks to do, and I appreciate what goes on here. And I made it clear to my staff that my first 100 days I wanted to make one of these council meetings so I could see what goes on, put a name to faces and faces to names, and to get my business card out, because this is a huge business line for the 1st District. If you think of the entire Coast Guard and fisheries enforcement, one-third of the boardings, fishery-wise, is done within the 1st Coast Guard District, and 40% of the violations are done within the 1st Coast Guard District. So this is the bulk of what we do. And really, what I really wanted to touch on just briefly this morning were three areas. One is how we do our enforcement mission. Two, search and rescue. And the third part is to talk a little bit about the fishing vessel safety program that Pete touched on. And, of course, those last two are pretty closely related. When it comes to enforcement, my commitment is a level playing field for those that are in this industry and to also assist those that make regulations so it's consistent with protecting and rebuilding the stocks, but also consistent with the safety of the fishing fleet so that we're not doing something with a second or third order effect that leads to a more dangerous occupation out there. I'm very sensitive to the fact that the economy is bad, and in many of these small New England communities, fishing is the community. And when they're impacted with rules that are made here and Coast Guard enforcement, it's a huge impact. On the resource protection, we combine effective presence, deterrence, professional over-the-rail enforcement, as well as constructive interaction with the fleet to combine those in partnerships with our state, local, and federal partners, again, to make sure that we're consistent with what this body seeks to do, which is to manage a natural resource out there. In addition to the case that Pete just talked about, we've had cases of hidden compartments that were discovered last year that I think was briefed out here. So there is a small minority out there, and you saw the statistics say most of the folks fishing out there are doing what they should. They're following the laws, and we're finding that. But still, there are folks out there that would seek to get an unfair advantage through violations, and we're going to catch them and do our best to hold them accountable. The attorney mentioned the fact that we've teamed up. We've offered some Coast Guard attorneys to help work on the backlog so there are legal consequences if we serve you with a violation to make sure that there's a price that's paid and you're not just waiting for something to happen. For search and rescue, the 1st District carried out over 3,000 cases last year, saved or assisted over 400 lives. Many of those cases related to the fishing fleet. We need to make sure that loss of life in the fishing community is not seen as a cost of doing business. I am sensitive to the fact that the old coasties in the room can tell you the motto in the Coast Guard used to be, you have to go out, but, what was the motto?
You don't have to come back.
I lived in a culture when I joined the Coast Guard in 1979 that assumed we were going to lose each other when we went offshore. Unacceptable. And the Coast Guard did a good job of changing the culture. So I'm seeking ways to help the fishing community do the same so they understand their boats and they understand the safety equipment, you know, importance of EPIRBs, radios, digital selective calling, Inmarsat, all those things that can help us help you. I would also say be mindful of the fact that at a minimum, you're going to own the first hour. It will take 30 minutes to get underway, either a helicopter, a jet, or a small boat. Those are 30 minutes that you are on your own. Then the time distance of physics kick in, and it's going to take probably at least a half hour to get to you. If you don't know how you're going to keep yourself alive offshore for at least an hour in those conditions, you better figure it out now before you get underway. That's what the Coast Guard needs from you. I'll do the best I can to get you, but you have to do your part. Good example, fishing vessel Linda happened this weekend, 150 miles offshore, 7 persons on board. She activated her EPIRB as well as called in on the radio, and she was taken on water through her engine room. The fishing vessel Julie G came alongside. Pumps were keeping up. Those folks had already donned their survival suits. The raft was at the ready, and they were ready to go into the water. We sent one of our jets out that dropped more dewatering pumps, and then our Coast Guard cutter Seneca arrived on scene. Their rescue and assistance team went over there, assisted with the airdropped pumps, worked hard, plugged a 3-inch hole in the engine room, dewatered the space, got the engines restarted, and she was escorted safely to home. She did a lot of things right, and the Coast Guard was able to do their job. But again, you own those initial hours until we can get there to help you. Finally, with fishing vessel safety, Pete hit the nail on the head. We are working with the industry to walk our way into the compliance and the requirements. So if sensitive to the fact that we've got a deadline looming ahead, but we're just asking that you contact the Coast Guard if you don't have a decal. We'll issue a letter that says when you're scheduled, and that's what you carry around until we can get there. These are rules that have been the same for 20 years. These are not safe, new safety regulations. And what we're hoping to do is, by being proactive, you owing me the first hour offshore when something bad happens starts to reduce, and we see less reaction and more proaction in the Coast Guard. Again, thank you for what you folks do. I'm excited to be back in the First District after serving on Cape Cod. I have flown over all the closed fishing areas, and a long time ago I was a boarding officer. I was quite glad I was in Miami, and it was where are the drugs. It's not show me a fish, and then I had to figure out what if it was a good fish or a bad fish. But I'm sensitive to what the folks do up here offshore. Open to any questions or certainly comments over lunch. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the Admiral? Thank you very much. Okay, we're at the lunch break. Let's return at 1:30, and we will start off with a EFP report from Chris Kellogg and then a motion from Frank.